Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Late last month, the superintendent of Oklahoma's public school system directed all of the schools in the state to include the Bible and the Ten Commandments in their teaching material. The superintendent called the Bible a necessary historical document. And just the week before, lawmakers in Louisiana passed a law that required schools to display the Ten Commandments in every classroom. The governor there said, if you want to respect the rule of law, you've got to start from the original lawgiver, which was Moses. Now, all of this seems to fit into a movement conceived by Christian conservatives that claims American democracy was founded on the values founders took from the Bible. This week, the biblical scholar Dan McClellan told us this preoccupation with the Ten Commandments isn't really all that old. He says it began after World War II, when the Cold War was setting in, and conservatives believed communism and atheism was infecting the country, especially our young people.
Juvenile delinquency is the big problem. So there's this judge, Rugemer is his name, who is responsible for sentencing this 16-year-old kid who stole a car. And what he comes up with, he orders the kid to find and keep on him a copy of the Ten Commandments as a way to ensure that our nation's youth are familiar with God's laws. This becomes a pattern, and he begins to expand this campaign into creating posters with the Ten Commandments on them and some little blurbs making the claim that this is the foundation of American society, of American jurisprudence, that our founding fathers knew that the laws of God were the foundation of all of this, which is wildly inaccurate, historically speaking. But this was a snowball that started rolling, and then the Fraternal Order of Eagles gets involved, and they have something like 7,000 of these posters made and distributed around the country in the early 50s. And then,
woe unto thee, O Israel! You have sinned a great sin in the sight of God. You are not worthy to receive these Ten Commandments.
Cecil B. DeMille comes on the scene doing publicity for this movie, The Ten Commandments.
Those who will not live by the law shall die by the law.
Cecil B. DeMille joins up with the Fraternal Order of Eagles and with this judge and orders a bunch of these granite monuments to be made and to be placed in public parks and near buildings like Capitol buildings and justice buildings and things like that. Obviously, a big part of this is publicity for this movie. He wants this movie to be successful, and it becomes probably the most seen movie ever from the 50s. And it's a big deal. It is a shot across the bow of communism, of atheism, and it begins America's notion that we need to return to our roots, our moral roots in the Bible and in God's law and in the Ten Commandments. And I think it represents not a third great awakening, but kind of a return to our civil religion. It's really an attempt to try to structure power, to try to get public spaces marked as belonging to this particular ideology. Basically, when people get anxious about their worldview and about social and political stability, they tend to return to identity markers that are foundational for them. And so a lot of conservative Christians immediately return to this idea of the Ten Commandments and posting them publicly to make sure everybody is aware of who's in charge and what ideologies are in charge.
If there is one more plague on Egypt, it is by your word that God will bring it. And there shall be so great a cry throughout the land
that you will surely let the people go.
I think in the 50s, there was an awful lot of anxiety about the world, and this was a way to reestablish the heart of American civil religion. And this movie was a big part of that. My wife's family, you know, they watched it every year. It was a part of their tradition. And she still is ashamed of the fact that I have actually never seen the movie. But I have spoken with all kinds of people who grew up in the mid-20th century who recall that this was, you know, this was their Christmas story. This is what you did every year. And this was kind of an anchor to the beating heart of their consciousness or conscience for this time period when there was so much tension and so much instability following World War II. We get into the Cold War, and then we've got a lot of stuff going on in the 60s that's causing a lot of instability. And so I think for a lot of people, I think the Ten Commandments is a nostalgic attempt to kind of, you know, it's a when America was great, quote-unquote, idea that makes a lot of people misty when they think about it. And so it still plays a significant role in people trying to return to innocence.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to go over the actual story of the Ten Commandments in the Bible, which, as you'll see, is way more complicated than the movie. Dan McClellan is going to take us through it. He's a biblical scholar with an incredibly popular TikTok channel. So let's start with the story that most of us know. Moses leads the Israelites away from bondage in Egypt and into the wilderness, across the Dead Sea, where they land at the foot of Mount Sinai. Moses climbs the mountain to receive God's law inscribed on these stone tablets, but it's taking a while, and the Israelites start to panic. So Moses' brother Aaron fashions another god for them to worship, an idol, a golden calf. Dan McClellan picks up the story from there.
Moses discovers Aaron and all the people are sinning with the golden calf. Mm. Moses, in a fit of rage, breaks the Ten Commandments, or according to the Mel Brooks version, he first drops 5 of the 15 and says, these 10 commandments. God instructs Moses to go back up the mountain and is supposed to be given 2 more tablets with the exact same laws written on them. And that's not exactly how the story goes in the Bible, but that's what we see represented in most media tellings of the story, because I think, you know, they have certain bases they need to tag, yeah, and then they have points they want to make and usually want to skirt over a lot of the stuff that strikes them as irrelevant or that is problematic in the narrative. And we have the same with the display of the Ten Commandments. They are conspicuously omitting things because it would kind of undermine the rhetorical goals of putting these things on display.
Yeah. 'Cause we'll get to the details of what they actually say in a second. But let me ask you this, though. How do you talk about the historicity of that actual story before we get to the complicated part of it? Mm-hmm. For believers, I think it matters that there was an actual figure named Moses who, as you said, has a backstory. He was delivered in a basket. He ended up in Pharaoh's household. And it includes the story of Israelites being enslaved by Egyptians. How much of that is near to the truth or actually happened? How much – what do you say to that part for people?
I say that the data don't support the historicity of the story of the Exodus as told in the book of Exodus. The data don't support the historicity of a figure like Moses as we see in the story of the Exodus.
Yeah.
This story, apart from the Song of the Sea, which is some poetry that we see in Exodus 15 – which tells the story a little differently from how the rest of the narrative goes, but most of the story is written in historical narrative prose. This happened, then this happened, then this person said this, then this person did this. And this was very common in the second millennium BCE and the early first millennium BCE. Most critical scholars today would say if there's narrative prose in the Bible, it comes from after that time period. And so the earliest that this story could have been told in the way that we find it in the text would be around 800 BCE. But most scholars would say it's probably a little later than that.
So hundreds and hundreds of years after the actual historical figure of Moses would have.
Yeah, and there's an early and a late theory about Moses. Apologists who try to defend the historicity of the Exodus. Some of them say Moses had to exist just before the year 1400 BCE. It kind of lines up better with the chronology in the Bible. And then there are others who say, no, it was actually just before the year 1200 BCE, because that's a slightly less problematic to align with the history of Egypt because we have Ramses around that time period and stuff like that. But yeah, the story definitely comes from many centuries after any such events could have taken place.
Okay, so we talked about the sort of more simplified story.
Yeah.
What's the actual story of the Ten Commandments?
Oh, it's complex,
yeah.
Because the book of Exodus is a compilation of several different stories, and you have a bunch of doublets. You have stories repeated with small differences in the details. Like even God meeting Moses on Mount Sinai, you have it told twice in two different ways.
In Exodus?
Yeah. Exodus 3 and Exodus 6. Hmm. And so in Exodus 3, Moses says, whom shall I say sent me? And God says, tell them, Echya Asher Echya, I am that I am. Say, I am sent you. And so this is God introducing themselves to Moses. Exodus 6, Moses says, God's here. And God says, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. I was known as El Shaddai to them, but by my name, Adonai, I did not make myself known to them. So we've got double introductions. Then we've got double laws. We have two different we actually have multiple different sets of laws. There's legislation handed down in Exodus 13, which is right around the institution of the Passover, right as they're leaving Egypt. We have Exodus 20. We have what's known as the covenant code from Exodus 21 to 23. We have what's known as the ritual decalogue in Exodus 34, which is ends with you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And it's actually right after that verse that it refers to that set of laws in Exodus 34 as the 10 words or the 10 things or what we now call the 10 commandments. So the only set of laws that's actually explicitly labeled the Ten Commandments is Exodus 34, the ritual decalogue.
There are dozens and dozens of commandments.
Well, there are 613 according to the formal kind of Jewish traditional count of commandments.
Wow.
And so the Ten Commandments is just kind of the introduction to what we now have in the covenant code. But they're never referred to as the Ten Commandments in Exodus. It's Exodus 34 that is referred to as the Ten Commandments.
But what do you think the school superintendent in Oklahoma or the lawmakers in Louisiana, what do you think they're – well, first of all, and I'm not kidding about this.
Mm-hmm.
Have they read the entire book of Exodus to make sense of that, do you think? And what do you make of their understanding of these layers? Do you think that they have an image, for example, of – an actual Moses with a quill pen or something writing out the book of Exodus. Like, what do you make of that?
I've said many times there's the Bible and then there's our interpretation of the Bible.
Yeah.
And these are not the same thing. The Bible is a set of squiggles. Texts don't have inherent meaning until a reader engages them within a set of circumstances. And those circumstances and that reader are going to govern how they're interpreted. And if you approach the book of Exodus with the Ten Commandments and Charlton Heston and the Prince of Egypt and Val Kilmer, and this means the world to you, and you think this is the foundation of Western civilization, then you're only going to see what is going to confirm your dogmas, your ideologies. I have no idea if they've ever read the entire book of Exodus. If they did, I have no doubt that it was read through those interpretive lenses, very thick interpretive lenses. I think when they think about the Ten Commandments as a political tool, it's primarily as an identity marker and a means of structuring power. Because as I mentioned before, this version of the Ten Commandments is omitting things. For instance, you won't worship any other gods before me. I am the Lord your God. who visits the iniquities of the fathers on their sons to the third and the fourth generation. Like, that's omitted. The notion that children have responsibility for the sins of the fathers, problematic within an American judicial setting. So obviously, delete. We got to get rid of that. We can't pretend that that is in the foundation of our nation. And so I think they're thinking about it primarily as, what can this do for me in my endeavors to try to structure power and values and boundaries? They don't show any signs to me of any kind of thoughtful engagement with the text. And what I've seen of their engagement with the actual history is even worse. Like, there's a claim that the founders quoted the Bible or cited the Bible more than any other document. And that is coming from a specific publication. There's research by Donald Lutz from the early 1980s where he shows that from 1760 to 1805, if you look at all political publications, the Bible is the most cited document. However, the overwhelming majority of those citations are from sermons reprinted in newspapers. It's not from the founding fathers. And Lutz even goes on to say, look, from 1787 to 1788, all the debates about the Constitution, the Federalists never once cite the Bible. The Anti-Federalists cite it 9% of the time. So the only people who are quoting from the Bible are the people who don't want the Constitution to pass.
Right.
It's never cited in the Federalist Papers. It's never cited in any of the documentation from the Constitutional Convention at all. It was not relevant. And this, and that period of the founding from like 1770 to 1790, 1805, that period is the period of the least religiosity in the history of the Americas. You know, the founders were deists. When Jefferson talks about the God of nature, this is a deist God. And Jefferson rejects explicitly. Jefferson, we have on record him arguing, our laws are not based on Christianity. It's based on English common law, which goes back before the arrival of Christianity to England. And so even Jefferson was like, no, you're not going to get away with that. This is not about Christianity. This is about something else.
But what about the argument, though, that, okay, it is those Ten Commandments that were set forth by God were the basics, that they were the letter of the law for society to order itself around. And before then, this presumes there was disorder, that there wasn't a set of laws. But clearly that can't be so. Were they ever – so I guess who gets credit for these basic 10? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So Exodus 34 is the only place where we have a set of laws that is explicitly labeled the Ten Commandments. But we do have that same phrase used in Deuteronomy 4 where it says, hey, we're going to have some laws, these Ten Commandments. And then in Deuteronomy 5, it quotes a version of what we have in Exodus 20. So indirectly, Deuteronomy identifies what we have in Exodus 20 as the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And they become, I think, the basis because they are just generic enough to have wide applicability. Like, it's not talking about boiling a kid in its mother's milk. It's not talking about, you know, this is how you're going to run this specific festival. It's pretty generic stuff. And by the time we get to the New Testament, we have within Greco-Roman period Judaism some ways of kind of digesting and interpreting law which result in this distillation of the Ten Commandments into a set of two, because the first four commandments are about, you know, your relationship with God.
Yeah.
The next six are about your relationship with the people around you. And so we have Jesus giving this distillation of the Ten Commandments down into the two great commandments. Love God with all your heart, might, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And
you said this is a New Testament thing. They distill.
Well, this is an early Jewish thing. So Greek-speaking Jewish folks and then later in rabbinic Jewish tradition are taking these laws and just trying to figure out how to, you know, rearrange them, how to think about them, how to systematize them, how to reduce them down. And this reduction of the Ten Commandments into the two great commandments is an example of that we find in the New Testament. So I think that's part of the foundation as well. When Americans look back, they are looking at the Ten Commandments through Christian lenses and Jesus as a first century representation of those commandments looms large in those lenses.
But surely other societies also said, hey, thou shalt not steal. Hey, you can't kill each other. I mean,
yeah.
This point has been made before that there wouldn't have been much left of sort of organized society if people would have allowed others to go around killing and stealing
right.
from each other.
Yeah, and those are incredibly generic principles that are just the foundation of the survival of society. And usually you didn't need to say it because it was so obvious. But there are law codes all around ancient West Asia. In fact, the Covenant Code, Exodus 21 through 23, is borrowed directly from the laws of Hammurabi, which come from about 1800 BCE. So probably around 1,000 years before the Covenant Code has been written, you have the laws of Hammurabi. And the Covenant Code is drawing from and altering a bunch of those laws. And so ancient Israel, the authors of the Exodus, did not originate any of these principles. Some people will claim that the Ten Commandments are quoting from the negative confessions of Ma'at, which is an ancient Egyptian text, comes from the Book of the Dead. There are 42 negative confessions where you say, you mention, evoke the name of a specific deity, and you say, I did not steal any food from the gods, and I did not kill anyone, and I did not bear false witness, and I didn't do – and there are 42 of them, and they're kind of repetitive, and some of them are very generic, and some of them are weirdly specific. But yeah, we see these principles in other places as well, and Israel's borrowing them, and sometimes word for word, sometimes they're massaging them a little bit, but they're coming from outside law codes. And this actually has a lot to do with how we understand Exodus, because when you look at the laws of Hammurabi, this was something that was carved into a large stele, a big stone phallic-looking thing that would have been on display in public. Very Cecil B. DeMille-esque, you might say. And we actually have records of lawsuits and court cases and things like this from around the same time and place.
That assert that thing?
Never. Never once does any piece of legislation from Mesopotamia ever cite any of the actual codes that were on display. And we find these rulings in these lawsuits that diverge from what is actually prescribed explicitly within these law codes, which leads a lot of scholars to believe that these law codes were propaganda, like Cecil B. DeMille wanted them to be, that they were actually for – they were show laws. They were to say, look how righteous and organized and just our king is. It's about putting on display your social and your cosmic justice. Most scholars think that Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, none of these laws were actually enforced when the texts were originally written. They were written for one of a handful of different reasons, either to function as scribal exercises, which is something that we find from the more established scribal schools in Mesopotamia and Egypt, where these were things that you remembered by rote because they were the things that you went to school and you copied down over and over again. And then they also functioned as propaganda. They were ways to for the king to show, I'm more important than the palace is more important than the temple, or for the temple to say, no, the temple is more important than the palace. And, this is rhetorical volleys going on well above the heads of the hoi polloi. This is something they were not aware of. And so this may explain why the laws conflict with each other in a bunch of ways. You look in Exodus, how long was a debt slave supposed to serve? 6 years. They go free in the seventh, except for the women, because you're basically sex slaves. You don't ever go free. Oh, what about Deuteronomy? Oh, male and female slaves, they all go free in the sixth year. What about Leviticus? 49th year. So you have three entirely different laws. They cannot have functioned together. And the notion that none of them were enforced at any point explains how they can be next to each other without having been enforced. Probably the middle of the second century BCE, when you have the rise of the Hasmonean kingdom. This is the Maccabean period. This is when they kick out the Seleucids and they rededicate the temple. And now we suddenly have a kingdom all over again. Have not had a kingdom for hundreds of years. Now we have a kingdom.
When they start obeying the laws.
A lot of scholars say this seems to be when we start to see pork is nowhere found in any of the archaeological sites. Suddenly, we're seeing indications of the celebration of certain festivals. Suddenly, people know about these laws. Suddenly, they're being enforced. And we also start to see, like I said, these distillations of the laws, these attempts to organize them and to harmonize them and to supplement them because they're incomplete.
So when you hear the political rhetoric of lawmakers in Louisiana and Oklahoma and elsewhere, you're seeing the through line between that and that same idea,
yeah,
hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
100%. This is an attempt to take these texts, which are not enforced. Like, there's no court in the country where you can hold up the Ten Commandments and say, that's why. They're just out there in order to signal to everybody, this is who we are. This is who's in charge of this space. And so now to say, oh, that's going in the classroom, it's a recapitulation of this judge saying, oh, this is about the children. Why won't somebody think of the children? Please think of the children. When, you know, the same folks are trying to put into office a man who is a proud violator of literally the majority of those laws. So they're not sincere. They don't follow these laws. It's an identity marker. It's laying claim to that space and saying, this is who's in charge, and this is the ideology that will govern these spaces. Same as it ever was, as the great poet said.
Right. Dan McClellan, he's a biblical scholar who holds a PhD in theology and religion from the University of Exeter. We'll come back to the story in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the biblical scholar Dan McClellan, and he's giving us a backstory for the Ten Commandments. Louisiana and Oklahoma are the latest states to require the public use of these laws found in the Bible, but we wanted to know exactly where they came from. We're talking about how the Ten Commandments worked in the ancient world and whether they should be considered relevant today. Okay, let's talk about the commandments themselves, or some of them anyway. We don't have time to sort of break them all down. I am really interested in some of these. And I want to talk about, I guess it's number three.
Mm-hmm.
Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Okay, so help us understand, what does that mean exactly, to take the Lord's name in vain? One of the things you've talked about is that there's this Hebrew verb here that's applied that is to lift or to bear or to carry. It means to take us to – what is that?
Yeah.
What is that? What would they have thought about that idea of taking – the Lord's name in vain?
Well, you have most scholars would say that the best way to contextualize this is to think of an oath. You see this idea of lifting up the voice, or sometimes you see where people will swear an oath using God's name, by the life of Adonai or something like that. And so the verb there to lift up the name of the Lord your God, of Adonai your God, is probably a reference to swearing an oath. And there are different contexts where you would swear an oath. You would swear an oath if you're trying to get somebody to do something for you. You know, I swear I'm gonna do all of this. I'm gonna return your shovel. Or something like that, but also in judicial context, and particularly in like ordeals, because back then, if there were no witnesses to a crime, there was not an awful lot they could do. And so one of the things that they would appeal to is ordeals. And you see, like, the ordeal of the bitter waters is a famous one from Numbers 5, where if a man suspects his wife of cheating on him, he drags her to the temple and the priest puts some dirt in some water and writes a curse and then scrapes the ink off of the paper into the water. And the wife drinks the curse and swears the oath.
Wow.
And then if she is innocent, she will, conceive. But if she's guilty, she becomes disfigured and infertile. And so oaths were a big deal. And, you know, you see this. And going back to Monty Python, you throw her in the water.
Yeah.
And if she floats, then she's a witch. You know, they had the idea that there were oaths in the Middle Ages. You throw the witch in the river. If she dies, she was not a witch.
Yeah.
If she lives, she was a witch. So it's lose-lose. But anciently, that was the idea was, have them swear an oath by the name of this deity, and the fear, invoking the deity's name and lying about it, was supposed to compel telling the truth. And so the idea here is, don't swear an oath falsely. And this is actually precisely—
But so it's not talking about this, or is it, the sacred invocation of the name of God? Because that's what people think about today, right?
Well, yeah, frequently. But no, this was probably written in a time period where there was no issue with invoking the name of God. Hmm. That's a later development. That's probably a development of Second Temple Greco-Roman period Judaism. So probably somewhere between the 4th to 1st century BCE, they develop a sensitivity to the pronunciation of the name. But in this time period, you would— you know, you've got a bunch of characters in the Bible who have God's name in their name. Like, you're pronouncing the name of God in a variety of different contexts. But here, the idea is don't raise your right hand and put your other hand on the Bible and swear that you're giving true testimony if it's a lie. And that's precisely what we see in another version of this commandment in Leviticus 19:12. It says, don't swear falsely by the name of God. And so it's Leviticus 19:12 is probably a more clear representation of what this commandment was intended to prohibit. Now, once they did develop that sensitivity and you weren't supposed to say God's name ever, the commandment becomes a little obsolete unless it's renegotiated. And so we have to come up with a new idea about what precisely this commandment was. There are a few different ways that this has gone. A lot of folks understand bearing the name to be operating as a representative. Like, you see this in the New Testament, in Revelation, those who overcome will write the name of my God on their forehead. You know, you're bearing the name because you're a representative of God. And so one interpretation that is more recent is don't break the commandments if you are a Christian or if you're representing Judaism or something like that. That is bearing the name in vain. And so that's one interpretation. You get the other classical one, the one that I didn't grow up being told this commandment, but my understanding of the commandment was, you know, don't say, oh, Lord, or something like that. Don't use God's name in an expletive or anything like that. So that's another reinterpretation.
But isn't that seems like the modern day interpretation of that? At least it seems to me that I hear from Christians.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think that's the most common. I frequently say that.
But the point is that there's not agreement about that.
Right. For the folks who take the Bible as authoritative, they want it to be meaningful and useful to them. And so they're going to negotiate it in a way that's going to do that for them. And for some, one interpretation is going to do that. For others, another interpretation is going to do that. So yeah, there is disagreement. And you'll see – I see a lot of progressive Christians or progressive folks who are wanting to co-opt the Bible to defensively against Christian nationalism, and conservative Christians will say, oh, that means – don't be a jerk if you're a Christian because you're bearing God's name. You're a representative of God, and so you've got to act the way God wants you to. So yeah, there are a variety of different interpretations that are deployed situationally to serve the deployer's rhetorical goals, whatever they may be. But that's just a function of the malleability of these texts because, again, there's the text and then there's our interpretation of the two, and they're very different things.
I think it's interesting the way even one that you would think would be as straightforward as thou shalt not steal can also be malleable. So let's talk a little bit about this. This is something you've actually – I think it was a – I'm not sure how long ago it was. This is something that you had posted because one of the questions that you had heard was whether or not thou shalt not steal could be – meaning thou shalt not there kidnap, and therefore be basically a commandment against slavery. Talk about that.
So there are a couple of other passages that are usually used to make this argument. One is Exodus 21:16, which is prohibiting kidnapping, but it's a little more complex than that. And the other one is in the New Testament. I think it's 1 Timothy, where we have this word, andropolistes, which is usually man-stealer or something like that is the way it's interpreted. So we've got this commandment, and we've got don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, and don't lie or don't bear false witness. Right. The first two and the fourth are pretty serious things. These are capital offenses.
Yeah.
And then don't steal if it's just generic, you know, don't steal anything at all, it feels a little out of place in between these capital offenses. And so a very, very early interpretive tradition understood this to refer specifically to kidnapping, because that would have the parallel in the covenant code in Exodus 21:16. And so there's an argument to make. It is a very ancient traditional interpretation. And I think probably not a strong majority, but I think a majority of scholars would say it's probably intended more generically to just be don't steal. But there are folks who want it to mean don't kidnap. And the folks who want it to mean don't kidnap sometimes want to insist that that means it's prohibiting slavery.
Because, here's the proof that, yes, that the Bible prohibits slavery.
Which is problematic, because every syllable of the Bible that has any relevance whatsoever to slavery presupposes its normativity and its acceptability. Now, there are passages that are basically saying it sucks when it happens to us, but you know, who doesn't think that way? Obviously, that they're going to think that way. The Bible condones or endorses slavery throughout. But if we understand slavery to be fed by kidnapping, that the slave trade is, you know, that's the lifeblood of the slave trade, then we can argue, oh, if you're not allowed to kidnap, then you're not allowed to engage in slavery. The problem is Exodus 21:16, where it talks about not kidnapping, it's actually referring to Israelite citizens. It's not saying anybody, because the covenant code distinguishes between laws having to do with foreigners, laws having to do with women, laws having to do with children, laws having to do with slaves. And it uses the word that is used to refer to male citizens in Exodus 21:16. And then in Deuteronomy, you have the parallel of this law, and it's quite a bit more explicit. Do not kidnap one of the sons of Israel. And we have this in the laws of Hammurabi, which also has a very robust slave trade and slavery system. And so the notion that prohibiting – one, it's not kidnapping anybody. It's kidnapping citizens. Two, even if it were kidnapping anyone, that would not preclude the slave trade, because most slaves were gained from foreign nations. Most slaves were purchased from other folks, or people entered into debt slavery. And you could buy and sell debt slaves as well.
According to the Bible.
According to the Bible, yeah. In fact, in Exodus 21, where it talks about how the female slaves who are sold by their father into debt slavery, they don't go free. They're perpetually debt slaves. And only it does place a restriction on the person who buys them. They're not allowed to sell them to a foreign master. But they could turn around and sell them to another Israelite, no problem. So the slave trade and then captives of war go into the slave trade. Children of slaves, like that's explicit in the Bible as well. If an Israelite man enters into debt slavery, they go free in the seventh year. But if they were given a wife by their master, the wife and all of their children stay with the master. So you can breed slaves as well. And, you know, when in the early history of America, we outlawed the international slave trade in the early 1800s, and slavery took off after that because we bred them. And that was how we fed the slave trade. So, yeah, it's a ridiculous argument, the notion that this in any way, shape, or form whatsoever prohibits or even speaks ill of slavery. It is entirely irrelevant to slavery, apart from prohibiting kidnapping Israelite citizens to send them into the slave trade. And in the New Testament, that word, anthropolistes, which is a reference to men stealers, in that time period, we can look at other literature, like a Greek text like Kalaroe and others, where it very clearly means illegal slave trading, not legal slave trading. Every nation that has had the slave trade, a slave trade, has had regulations on it. And one of the funny things people – not funny, one of the awful things but ironic things is people who talk about the American slave trade will say, oh, they didn't have any rules. They could do whatever they wanted. Well, that's what has come – that those are the historical events. That's the historical reality that comes down to us. Most people are not aware that there were plenty of laws about how you were supposed to be able to treat slaves. They just weren't enforced. We only have – the reality on the ground from early American slavery. When it comes to the Bible, we only have the laws on the books. We don't have the reality on the ground. So it's comparing apples to oranges to say biblical slave trade was one way, American slave trade was the other. We cannot know the precise relationship of the two.
Dan McClellan, he's a public scholar of religion in the Bible. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going over the actual story of the Ten Commandments in the Bible with the public scholar Dan McClellan. Back now to our conversation. So I think the question that is coming up now in the conversation about these two stories about the Ten Commandments in Louisiana and Oklahoma, and it seems clear that the number of states doing that may grow, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tried it in Texas. We tried it here in Utah. It's with the exact same wording from the Ten Commandments, because they all pulled from the Fraternal Order of Eagles wording, because that's what got past the Supreme Court.
Well, so explain that to us.
Yeah.
Because I think when the pushback comes, as you said, there were – you mentioned in the 1950s this – we then sort of get settled on the 10 and the actual kind of wording.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, there was some resistance here and there, but the real pushback seems to come at the beginning of the 2000s. And then there were these court cases. So give us a sense of where the Supreme Court seems to have landed on all of this, at least for now.
Yeah, well, we have 2005 Van Orden versus Perry. So this is where you had after Roy's Rock – in 2001, you begin to have people going, wait a minute, what is all this stuff doing here? And you had some suits that were brought, particularly related to one of these Ten Commandment displays in Austin, Texas. And this goes up to the Supreme Court. And they decide that they are going to allow this display in Austin, Texas. But there's another case regarding some displays in another state, McCleary versus ACLU. And there they say, no, we're not going to allow this. One violates the Establishment Clause, one does not. And the reason that DeMille and Fraternal Order of Eagles display gets by is because it had been there for 50 years. And the McCleary – no, actually, I think it was in the 60s that the one in Austin was put in. But anyway, the McCleary one, those were more recent, and they had a lot more kind of supplementary claims around it about the role of the Ten Commandments in American civil religion and all this kind of stuff. And so they said, well, this one's been here for so long, and this has more of a secular vibe than a religious vibe. Mm-hmm. And there was this test called the Lemon Test that used to be what you the scrutiny you had to pass in order to get around the Establishment Clause. I think Rehnquist was the one who wrote for the majority in Van Orden v. Perry, but basically throws out the Lemon Test gets thrown out later, but doesn't use the Lemon Test and just says it's been there for so long, it's part of our history, it has a secular function. The others are very clearly more religious, so they don't count, but the Texas one stays. And then the Lemon Test gets thrown out in 2022 with, I think, Bremerton School District v. Perry, which is the high school football coach is praying on the 50-yard line after the games and gets fired and then sues. And this is where, 6-3 ruling, anyone who's got a pulse in the 21st century knows what 6-3 ruling means. And they basically reorganize the tests, the standards, and basically say if it's part of our national history or heritage or something like that, then it's fine. And so the Lemon Test –
if that gets to the Supreme Court today, either of those two laws or requirements – in Louisiana, a state law which requires a copy of the Ten Commandments be posted at every public classroom. That's mm-hmm. one. In Oklahoma – that there's a requirement that public school teachers not just use the Ten Commandments in their instruction, but also the Bible from the Bible itself. So if either of those gets to the Supreme Court now, what are their chances?
Pretty much everybody thinks that this will be another 6-3, that this is constitutional. Now, I think Oklahoma is probably a lot more complex just because – the state does not have a the case that we need to teach the Bible in calculus and in gym is just laughable. So I would hope that that somebody could be reasoned with at the Supreme Court. But the Ten Commandments display, it's word for word the display from Van Orden v. Perry, and that is very intentional. That is already – it already has precedent. It has already passed the test, and so they're using that in the hopes that it'll get through, and I think most people are pretty confident that it will. I'm not a lawyer. My brother and my uncle are lawyers. They know this kind of stuff much better than I do, but the legal minds I have seen commenting on this that I trust have all said, yeah, this seems pretty clear-cut based on the way they have renegotiated the Establishment Clause and how to test it.
Dan McClellan, why are we having this argument today? It doesn't seem to be a practical argument. It seems like there's something else symbolic, I guess, maybe going. What do you think?
I think there's some practicality to it. It is the people who have long been in the halls of power are being threatened by the United States of the 21st century, where there are an awful lot of people who used to not have any access to power or resources who are now changing things. And there are efforts out there to demonize anything and everything from, you know, it was CRT for a while, then it was wokeness for a while, now it's DEI. There are all kinds of ways that cis-hetero white men and the women who are carrying water for them are trying to structure power and values and boundaries so that they can hold on to their power because they're threatened by a society where, you know, you see this all over the place. I can't remember all of the folks who are saying stuff, but on Twitter and on social media, you're seeing a lot of people, a lot of conservative voices saying, oh, you know, my neighborhood has a bunch of Hindus in it now, and this isn't my America. And the whole Make America Great Again slogan and movement and mindset is, I'm going to go back to a time where I was in control and all of these folks around me who now want power knew their place. It is people, their way of life, their position at the top of the pecking order is being threatened, and I think it's a lashing out. It's a trying to dig in the heels and trying to return to a time when, you know, even your Hispanic, even your Asian, even your Egyptian characters in movies were all played by white guys with different shades of shoe polish on their face because they're more comfortable with a system that privileges them over and against others. And they can't imagine what it might be like to live in a world where there is equality. And there's a saying, I don't know who coined it, but it's a fabulous saying: when you're used to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And there are an awful lot of white men out there who feel very, very oppressed right now.
Final question. Do we need the Ten Commandments? Do we need something like a proclamation of basic laws, even laws that say something about our relationship to a deity?
A deity, I don't think we need that for a pluralistic society today. I am not one who's going to say it shouldn't be allowed. I'm a religious person. I'm a person of faith. I keep it private, though. And I think if anyone thinks that the founding of the nation back in the late 18th century ought to have any kind of the principles anyway, ought to have any kind of role today. One of the reasons that they instituted the separation of church and state is because of the divisiveness of religion. They did not want the divisiveness, so they just wanted to leave it out altogether. As far as basic moral principles like don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, I've been hearing my entire life that it's the responsibility of parents and families to teach their kids about those kinds of things. And I've been hearing that it's not the state's role to be involved in any of that. And so suddenly why there's been a pivot to saying, no, the state has to be involved in all of this. And this serial adulterer and rapist who needs to be the one to be at the wheel. Yeah, this is all propaganda. This is all an attempt to try to maintain a grip on power that's been loosening for many years now. And I don't see a legitimate argument to make for the public and the state endorsement or enforcement of these rules. It's we don't follow them, Some of them are not good to begin with, and even the Tenth Commandment, as it is prescribed in that legislation, says not to covet your neighbor's wife or slaves. And a wife is not a piece of property, and we don't do slavery anymore. So obviously, well, we don't do slavery in the vast majority of contexts, but obviously these rules are problematic in a lot of different ways. And so I think we can do better without them.
Dan McClellan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan McClellan, he's a biblical scholar and an honorary fellow at the University of Birmingham's Cadbury Center for the Public Understanding of Religion. He also co-hosts the podcast Data Over Dogma. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. I'm Doug Fabrizio.